Dr. Mike Hart is finally with us here today. And just so you guys could get his reaction, we wanted to wait. Dr. Mike Hart, do you know that Canada has officially, by the sounds of it, what we're being told, has tabled MAID for mental illness?
Yeah, that's absolutely disgusting and appalling. But at the same time, like, I'm actually not surprised, just because it's Canada and it's Justin Trudeau and it's Canadian healthcare, and I work in healthcare and I understand what's going on.
So I'm really glad, because the amount of trolls I'm getting right now, ever since we came out against MAID expansion for the mental illness and also for children, which people cannot actually fathom. So they think I'm lying and they think I'm crazy and they think that people aren't actually being offered MAID strictly on mental illness diagnoses, but they are, and they've been pushed in that direction. And a lot of doctors have come out saying, no, we're not doing this at all, when we have complete full record of it happening.
Yeah, that's wild. I mean, I completely, like, when the MAID program came out, like, I wasn't against it because I thought they would just be using it for people who had ALS, or, like, you know, palliative care patients who have, like, irretractable pain and, you know, want to die with dignity sort of thing. And, you know, if you're palliative and constantly in pain every day, you've lived a good life, you know, by all means, if you make that decision, I think that's pretty reasonable. But I mean, for someone who has, like, mental health, especially when they're younger, like, everyone's mood changes all the time. You know, like, even day to day, like, hour to hour, your mood can change a little bit. You know, it's normal to, you know, have symptoms of depression or have symptoms of, you know, sadness sometimes. It's not normal to have them all the time, no. But of course, like, you know, people just need to get used to kind of, like, experiencing these symptoms and accept them a little bit more than trying to, you know, not necessarily, like, you know, fix everything right away. I'm certainly not saying, like, don't work on yourself, but what I am saying is, like, you know, if you are experiencing some of these symptoms, it's normal. Like, everybody goes through, you know, these different symptoms. We're all human. We experience different emotions, you know, anger, sadness, grief, like, we all experience these kind of things. So, you know, I think it's awful that they're, you know, taking a relatively normal symptom for some people and then they're offering them MAID. Like, it's quite literally completely insane.
It is massively insane. And so I'm just going to tell everyone the date right now, because this is going to come out in a few weeks, but I will say it's January 30th. So we, last night before I went to bed, I got a call from Alicia Duncan, whose mother was taken off the face of the earth due to falling through the cracks and being a psych nurse, knowing how to gain the system to access MAID after being suicidal. And we've spoken about on the Brass and Unity podcast with her and several other podcasts about her, because her case is particularly fascinating, because the police got involved around that particular incident. And so I got a phone call from her last night saying, oh my God, we actually did it. We think at this point, what they have come out and said is that Canada is not ready. Canada is not ready. There's been multiple psychiatrists that have come forward during testimony and stated that it is almost, if not impossible, to diagnose someone and allow them to use MAID for a mental illness. It is almost impossible to say that somebody will not heal from something, including the mental illness. And I could not echo that any louder, because it is so obviously true that emotions ebb and flow like the ocean. They are going to change based on your diet, based on how well you slept that night, based on the way that you surround yourself with individuals. But then you have these people. You have people like Dying with Dignity Canada, who have come out on their website and advocated for rape victims to be allowed to use MAID. You have prisoners in Fernie, I think it's out in Fernie here in BC. In April, a prisoner got to access MAID, not due to any terminal illness, but due to a mental health regulation. And the thing that scares me about this expansion into mental health is not only the vulnerable individuals down to the age of 12 that were going to initially be allowed access, but it is that this thing you just stated at the very beginning of this, Mike, which was mental illness ebbs and it flows. Depression ebbs and it flows. And what do we see such a high propensity of post-COVID? Anxiety, depression, mental illness.
Yeah. I mean, one of the biggest things for mental illness is isolation. You know, when people are depressed or when people are anxious, they don't want to leave their homes. And one of the questions I ask all my patients, you know, especially my PTSD patients or patients who have, you know, treatment resistant depression or really any type of mental health disorders, how many days a month are you leaving your home? Because that gives me a very, very good impression as to how well they are doing. Yes, there are things like functional depression and things like that that go on. But when I have a vet who tells me that, you know, he's only left his house 2 or 3 days in the past 2 months, obviously I know something's going on there. Obviously, when a vet tells me that, you know, he went into the grocery store, he got all of his groceries in his grocery cart, and then he went to the line, couldn't do it, and just left the grocery in his cart and left. Like, I know something's going on there. So, you know, that's like, and like what that is learned fear. And, you know, I say this to my patients all the time, like no one's born afraid to go, you know, to the grocery store. No one's born afraid to go up to a girl at the bar and ask her on a date. Like no one's born afraid to do these things. But what happens is through trauma, through life experiences, we kind of, you know, gain these micro traumas that become, they develop into major traumas where eventually, you know, we can't get outside of our house. And so when that happens, you know that you're, you know, in trouble. And, you know, not to change the subject to
cannabis, go for it.
But, you know, one of the reasons why I talk about and preach CBD so much. So for people who don't know, CBD is cannabidiol, or one of the non-psychoactive cannabinoids in cannabis. What that can do and what's been shown in rat model studies, and I've seen this in my patients, is that it does decrease learned fear. And essentially that's what PTSD is. That's what social anxiety is. That's what mostly all these anxiety disorders are, learned fear. And what we need to do is to unlearn that fear. So for example, you know, and I didn't mean to go off too much of a tangent.
Please go.
But just going, getting back to, you know, the vets who say, you know, they can't go to the grocery store, like that kind of thing. What you want to do is you want to do graded exposure therapy. Okay. Exposure therapy is by far the best treatment for any anxiety disorder. So what's exposure therapy? You expose yourself to whatever you are afraid to, and then eventually you just become less afraid to it. You know, people do that in their lives, you know, without even necessarily knowing it sometimes, but I'm not saying, you know, take a shot of CBD, go into, you know, Costco at 2 p.m. on a Saturday. No, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is make you, you know, take a shot of CBD and then maybe take someone with you, and then maybe go like 9 p.m. on a Monday night, and, you know, only go in and get a few things, you know, that kind of thing. And then maybe the next time you go in at 8:30 p.m., maybe you don't take the person with you, maybe you get a couple more things, but you develop some type of plan where it's graded. And then eventually, once you expose yourself, you know, enough and enough, hopefully you get to a point where you can go to the grocery store by yourself, you know, in the middle of an afternoon, even if it's busy, and pick up your groceries and not have any anxiety about it.
From a personal perspective, I had no success with exposure therapy after doing it for a lot of years. But what I can say is that I do know at the time that I was given exposure therapy, it was too early. We weren't at the place where that was going to be successful more than it was in stress inducing. But once we did hit a certain plateau point, that's when that was a better opportunity. It was I was more accessible at that point. There was just a point there where I was so drugged up that you couldn't get through to anything due to the 11 over drugs that they were putting into my system. But that's fine.
So basically what happened there was your brain was in a state where it couldn't probably build new neural connections.
Right, exactly. Right?
Because you were on so many different medicines, so many drugs, there's so many things being tampered down your brain that you couldn't build these new connections. And then the other part of that too is, yes, there is something called flooding, which, you know, I don't necessarily use, but say if someone's, you know, super afraid of snakes, instead of doing, you know, or even coming back to our example of the grocery store, instead of, you know, going at 9 p.m. with someone just to get a couple of items, like, okay, we're just going to put you in the most stressful situation at first and see what happens. And, you know, sometimes people come out of it and they do well with it, you know, but for the most part, you know, graded exposure therapy is going to be best. And if someone is very, very vulnerable, then the exposure has to be extremely graded. I mean, you have to, you know, take it very, very easy on the first step, but as long as you're making progress, that's the most important thing. You know, never be hard on yourself just because you're not at a point where you can go to Costco at 2 p.m. you know, on a Saturday. You know,
nobody can go to Costco at 2 p.m. on a Saturday and feel good.
It is a pretty shitty thing to do. I would never ever choose to do that. But my point is, you know, if you get to a point where you can do that, then you know you've had, you know, a lot of success and you're doing much better.
So let's just roll right into the plant medicine conversation then anyway. Sure. I was really stoked to have you on the show. I've been on your show and I really appreciated the viewpoints that you brought forward, not only for the veteran space, but also just for the civilian population, whether it's understanding the brain a little bit differently, speaking openly to topics that a lot of people are fearful of speaking about due to losing their licenses or their college. But I do see you being a voice for individuals in that way on social media. So let's talk more about plant medicine. You speak to cannabis, but let's shift gears a little bit to treatment-resistant depression and some of these things that the SAP process in Canada, people are getting access to regulated psilocybin with. What are your thoughts on psilocybin as I'm wearing an entire mushroom sweater? What are your thoughts on psilocybin and the healing capacity that they hold for others?
Okay, I do want to answer that question, but I want to kind of define treatment-resistant depression first.
Okay. The reason I use the term treatment-resistant depression is because I have access through the special access program. I'm one of the patients who has been approved by Health Canada. So I'm considered treatment-resistant, which makes me giggle inside, but it's only because I opted out of electroshock therapy as one of their main ways to treat my treatment-resistant depression. So please do define what that looks like.
So in general, if you talk to most docs and if you, you know, check most websites, what they'll say is treatment-resistant depression is a failure of one. Sometimes it's usually been classically been two or three more SSRIs, SNRIs, like classically used antidepressants. So they failed on these and they didn't get better. So then they have treatment-resistant depression. And, you know, I understand that definition, but I think that it needs to be expanded greatly. Mm-hmm. And I actually, you know, touched on this recently. I made a post on it. So there's so many things that I think, you know, should be done before you label yourself with treatment resistant depression. And it shouldn't be just a failure of one or two SSRIs. So some of the things that you need to do, you need to get sunlight in the morning. So, so important. You need to make sure that you have a good steady bedtime. So you want to make sure that you wake up and go to bed at the same time every day. It's critically important. And I know it's a bitch on the weekends, but you know, even if you just stay up an extra hour, hour and a half on the weekends, sleep in maybe an extra hour, hour and a half, you know, don't go too much more than that. I think that's critically important. You need to make sure that your nutrition is good, right? So you need to make sure that you have a good diet. You're getting plenty of protein, plenty of vitamins, and you need to make sure that you're getting, you know, like I said, at least about 1 gram of protein per pound is optimal for people. Also, like I just said, you need to make sure that you're not socially isolating yourself, right? You need to make sure that you're exercising. Exercise is incredible for depression. It's incredible for anxiety. Now, some people say, you know, what do you do if you're too depressed to exercise? Well, you know, I understand, you know, you could maybe be too depressed to like run a marathon, or maybe you're too depressed to go do like a massive deadlift workout. But, you know, somehow, some way you got to get up, just even if it's walking around your house or walking around your block, you know, something that you can do will make a difference. And so anything you can do with regards to exercise, I think is going to make some kind of a difference overall. So, you know, those are just a few things that, you know, people should be doing before they label themselves treatment resistant depression. But, you know, I could go on probably about, you know, 15 or so other things, but those are sort of like the main things. And I think that, you know, people aren't doing those things and they're getting an SSRI. Of course, it's not working because they're not doing everything else they need to do. And then they get labeled with treatment resistant depression.
Which is wild too, because when you look at what an SSRI does to the brain, it's not creating serotonin for you. It's just rationing your serotonin across the board. And people wait for these things to kick in and to start working. But what I've been able to see over personal experience and having either clients or other individuals in the veteran space going through having more SSRIs put onto their system and other medications put onto their system is there's just this constant plateau of frustration and anger. And
brought to you by Mindful Meds. You guys have been seeing me take Mindful Meds for a little while now. Mindful Meds is a premium supplement company dedicated to supplying humans with the tools to improve their mental health, clarity, and performance, all while supporting their growth along the way. Whether it's the Immunity Blend, Lion's Mane, Inspire, or Voyage, all of their products are clean, tested, consistent, and they've become a huge help in my life. I found Mindful Meds over a year ago now, and I've never looked back. Go check out their website, mindfulmeds.io, and use the code BRASS at checkout.
First and foremost, I've gotten to a point with Canadian doctors where I very much believe that if the first question is, how is your sleep? How is your diet? How is your social cues going on? If that's not the first set of subset questions that come through before, hey, we need to check you for medication, we need to check you for deficiencies, you have a drug dealer. You don't have a doctor, you have a drug dealer. And that is just the constant, I've seen this over the past 15 years over a subset of doctors, social workers, psychiatrists, psychologists. Part of the problem has been this idea that we can just constantly throw medication at problems instead of allowing the individual to take ownership and see what they can do with their body first before taking medication. But it's no different than anything else. You're seeing a similar reaction with things like Ozempic, which I do want to talk to you about a little bit because I'm getting conflicting reports on people's opinions on Ozempic. And so I do want to get into that at some point. But so lean into a little bit more of this plant medicine idea with you, because I do know you have your patients using cannabis and I do know that you see success with that. How do you find cannabis affects hormones when you have somebody that's using it on a higher dose?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. So first of all, CBD doesn't seem to affect hormones negatively in any way. So you don't have to worry about that one. With THC, it seems to be with higher doses, you may get a little bit of a drop in your testosterone level. So because of that, you know, I advocate for my patients to use CBD. Again, everyone is different, and this is more of like an ideal, and I understand everyone can't do this, but ideally what I want people to do is use CBD only during the day. And then at night, use a combination of CBD and THC. But now, again, I understand that there's some people who are, you know, if you just got back from Afghanistan, or if you just, you know, got back out of a very, very traumatic situation, you know, you may need some high THC for a few months to really, you know, put you to sleep and get those nightmares away. But for the most part, you know, the goal should be to use, you know, more CBD in the daytime and then just use a combination at night. And then like anything, you know, you can sort of offset, you know, some potentially, you know, poor behaviors. So just like, you know, when we're talking about THC and using it and maybe it drops, you know, your testosterone level a little bit, there's things you can do. You can check your testosterone level. You can make sure that it's not dropping. You can make sure that you're not using too much THC. And then you can also do things naturally that can increase testosterone. So, you know, Tungkat Ali has been shown to increase testosterone. Boron is an easy supplement that you can take that can also increase free testosterone by decreasing sex hormone binding globulin. So, you know, there are different ways where you can kind of mitigate it. And so I don't think that should be a deterrent for people who are interested in using THC.
Hey there, humans. I know you guys have seen it, that crown on the top of my head. Well, that is from Three Horses Hat Co. And they are 100% beaver felt hats. That's the highest quality hat you can get. And each one is handmade in Nashville, Tennessee. Three Horses does both custom and one-off hats. They've never made the same hat twice. So if you design your own, they'll never make it again. If you feel like you can't find a hat that fits your style, that's all right. Go check out Three Horses Hat Co. Use the code BRASS. Get 15% off. Embrace the fever. Live the dream.
I'm glad that you bring that up because we do hear that a little bit when we're dealing with traumatic brain injuries and we're looking at blood panels on a regular basis about the levels of hormones are so, so important when you're working with TBIs. They're so necessary to be checking your blood work if you're supplementing with different things that you're not really sure if you're even high or low in. So let's talk a little bit. Let's shift a little bit and talk about blood work because in Canada, it does seem like it is quite a struggle to get accurate blood work done. That is absolutely necessary when it comes to dealing with some of these little more tricky issues, PTSD and TBI, high inflammation, having to supplement with hormone replacements. So talk to me a little bit about your experience as a doctor in Canada and what that's been like trying to treat patients accurately.
Sure. Well, one thing I think I should say from the outset, particularly if we're talking about hormones, but also looking at, you know, cardiovascular risk factors. And, you know, most of us listening to this probably are going to die of heart disease. You know, heart disease runs in my family. It's probably what I'm going to die of too. So, you know, when we're looking at blood tests in Canada, we know that, you know, our healthcare supposedly is free, and it is in some ways. But when you look at doing blood tests, if you want to do like a really comprehensive panel, a lot of those tests are actually not covered. So, you know, your total testosterone is covered in Canada, your free testosterone is covered, which is excellent. If you want to do a PSA, for most guys, they have to pay $30 or $40, maybe even a little more. Vitamin D, which, you know, again, can be linked to low testosterone.
Omegas.
$35 or $45 for something like that. SHBG. So just to explain what that is. So you have total testosterone and free testosterone, but unfortunately only about 1 or 2% of the testosterone in our body is free. Most of it is bound up. So it's bound up mostly to something called SHBG. So that particular test, SHBG, is very expensive in Canada. I think it's like $70 or something like that. So, you know, again, if you want to do a real good hormone panel, I think you should absolutely get that test done. Another test that costs a lot of money in Canada is a DHT test. So DHT is something I've talked about a little bit before, because it gets a little bit of like a bad rap, because, you know, people think that, you know, I want to have my DHT as low as possible because it's going to prevent male pattern baldness, and it's also going to prevent prostate cancer. And there is some truth to that. But the other part is that, you know, low DHT is also linked to really poor mental health, poor cognition, memory issues, poor blood sugar control. So there's a lot of things that, you know, go into, you know, regulating DHT. And the other part of DHT too, that I should mention, because a lot of guys take finasteride or Propecia, right, for hair loss, and that actually lowers DHT. So again, you know, if you're someone who's like really gung-ho on not losing your hair, you don't care if your DHT drops and your energy, you know, goes a little bit, then, you know, I guess Propecia is for you. But for a lot of people, I really like to warn them, you know, about that. So that's just a little bit on the testosterone side, but also too, I should mention, because, you know, you were mentioned about TBIs and stuff. So growth hormone is something that, you know, a lot of people should have tested as well. So the test that we use in Canada is an IGF-1 test. Again, very, very expensive test. I think it's like $90 or something, or something crazy to get that test. So, you know, pretty expensive test. So I guess my point, you know, regarding hormones in Canada is that if you are going to get testing done and you do want to get like, you know, a real full panel for testosterone, get everything checked, you know, these are a couple of tests that unfortunately, you know, you will have to pay for. And I can get into the cardiovascular ones too. I'm not sure if I answered your original question, but I just remember, I just remember when you asked it, I was like, I got to talk about this first.
No, I'm really glad you did. And you absolutely did. I do know that when you're managing ongoing chronic health issues in Canada, it is quite difficult to get certain blood work done to the point where we get our naturopath to pull our blood and we send it down to America, because the last blood test my husband got 2 weeks ago cost us $900 in Canada. So,
holy shit.
Yeah. So my point in saying these things is, you know, I hear a lot of, I'll hear a lot of clients and individuals say, well, I want to go get my blood work done. I want to go check my levels. I want to kind of go see where I'm at. I want to put it into Inside Tracker, and I want to play with it and see what I can be doing. And I think that's incredibly amazing to have people wanting to be proactive with their health and their internal systems, because ultimately so many people are taking supplements and other vitamins that they have absolutely no clue whether it's even needed or what will happen if you have certain genetic components. So I think it's so important to discuss the realities around blood work, because it's one thing to say, go get your blood work. It's another when it's costing people an arm and a leg to actually do so, to look after themselves. So I want to shift a little bit into some personal sides of you before we dive a little more into the medical component, because we found out about you originally way back on Joe Rogan quite a while ago, and it was refreshing to see a Canadian doctor. This is obviously well before Jordan Peterson was a Jordan Peterson. It was really refreshing to, I don't really know what to say. It's like before.
Yeah, that's exactly Jordan the way you should say it. Yeah.
Right? It's like, how do I stumble across that? But it was the first time that I had started to see Canadian doctors speaking out about a lot of different issues, a lot of different things personally they were finding going on in systems. And so talk to me about how you decided you even wanted to step into this profession, because it is very frustrating, I can imagine. And I can also imagine it feels like your hands are tied behind your back sometimes, depending on systems. So talk to me about that life choice.
Sure. So I'll try not to go back too far, but, you know, originally in university, I actually started out doing engineering because, you know, I was kind of better suited for like math kind of thing. And then immediately when I got in, I was like, I do not want to be an engineer. This sucks. I do not want to do this. But I was, even at that time, I was very, very interested in nutrition. I was into working out like right away. Like even when I was like 14 or 15, I got into working out. And so I was like, okay, I'm just going to do what I like. So I did nutritional biochemistry. And then as I was doing nutritional biochemistry, I was like, okay, what am I going to do with this after? I'm going to apply for medical school, you know, and I'm going to be, you know, a doctor that can, you know, really know a lot about nutrition and kind of take care of patients, so to speak. And so anyways, I went into medical school, and then I did my family residency, and then got into Western. And so that's where I am now in London, Ontario, and I'm staying, been here now for just about 10 or 12 years, something like that. And so, you know, that was kind of my journey to get into it. And then as I got into medicine, like right away, I knew that I wanted to use cannabis for my patients. Because mostly for initially, it was because of sleeping. So, you know, patients would come in and they couldn't sleep. And, you know, at that time I was using cannabis to sleep. And I was just thinking like, you know, I wish I could just tell them, like, if you just like use a little bit of weed, like you'd probably be able to sleep, you know? And then, so 2014 came out this MMA, our program in Canada, which kind of made it much, much easier for physicians to prescribe cannabis. So I was, that was the MMPR program. The MMAR program, which I was never really part of, that was basically you'd fill something out for someone to grow weed for them. Right. And so the person could grow themselves, or they can even have someone else designated to grow for them. So it was a really, really weird system. Again, I was never, you know, a part of it. I just kind of joined at the exact right time, just by fluke, when I was graduated, you know, the MMPR program came out. And so, you know, I got right into cannabis, and I understood that, you know, this is an incredible medicine. It's, you know, much, much more just beyond the THC that can help people sleep. You know, CBD came out, a lot more studies came out, you know, veterans started using it, started talking about it. And then it kind of just became a little bit of a snowball. But, you know, as I said, I was always into, you know, living, I guess, most optimally healthy life that like I could possibly live. And so I've always been interested in any treatment modality that could, you know, help me out and to improve. And that doesn't make me, you know, anti-pharmaceutical in any way, shape or form, but I just, you know, still study alternative treatments, you know, as much as I study pharmaceutical treatments.
Have you seen that be a conversation around you, being anti-pharmaceuticals?
I mean, certainly some people say that I have like a holistic approach, and, you know, I appreciate that. And I think that's great. And I think I do have a holistic approach. I know some people think that, you know, I think too much about supplements or too much about, you know, certain alternative treatments, but I'm not anti-pharmaceutical, you know, whatsoever. You know, like we'll probably talk about later on, like I prescribe ketamine, which is a pharmaceutical, you know, technically any hormone replacement that I prescribe, you know, testosterone, estrogen, progesterone, like these technically are all, you know, pharmaceuticals. So, you know, you just have to, you know, watch it. You know, there's certain pharmaceuticals that are much, much easier to prescribe. Like if someone has dark green, thick mucus and a cold, I really don't care about giving them, you know, an antibiotic. I think that that's, you know, absolutely the best course of action to take. But, you know, if someone has back pain, you know, getting them on opioids long-term, obviously that's something that I'm, you know, very much against. Mm-hmm. So you just have to know when to use pharmaceuticals and when to not use them.
Yeah, no, that's what they're there for. Antibiotics. That's what we created. We went through the hell of what is the 1900s finding things that can cure people. It's when you get individuals in power who then take those and abuse them. And then that's where you see things like the opioid epidemic, especially on the east side of Vancouver, which is really sad to witness more than it is anything else. So talk to me a little bit more about some of the ways that you like to have a holistic approach, because I would take that as a compliment in this day and age more than anybody else should. A holistic approach is a well-rounded approach, in my opinion. It is one that looks at every different facet of a human being rather than just saying you have localized pain here and not addressing where that localized pain could be stemming from and how it could be all affecting the entirety of the body. So when you started to do this holistic approach and you started to lean into more, maybe say the plant medicine side of things, how has that been received not only by your patients, but by those kind of around you in the environment of the Canadian healthcare system?
Yeah. So good, really good question. So for most of my patients find it to be very, very refreshing, you know, and a lot of people say that, you know, I wish I had used cannabis before. Like, I can't believe that, like, you know, this has been around for 30 years and, you know, I've been suffering all this time and no one's offered me this. And, you know, that happens particularly, I find, for patients who have migraines. You know, migraines can be very, very difficult to treat. And some of the medications out there, you know, like Imitrex and that, they can help, but, you know, they also can cause some side effects and some people just don't feel well when they use them. You know, cannabis, on the other hand, and there is some controversy about this, but Dr. Ethan Russo, who's out in your area, he you know, has coined this term, the endocannabinoid deficiency. So basically he thinks that just like you can be deficient in vitamins, you can be deficient in hormones, you can also be deficient in cannabinoids. And one of the three conditions is he's identified that is with migraines. And so that may be the reason why migraine sufferers respond so well to cannabis, is that we're just, you know, replacing something that should be there naturally. And, you know, as you know, people listen to this may know, you know, we do have a natural endocannabinoid system. There's endocannabinoids even, or there's cannabinoids even in breast milk. So, you know, we know that we are supposed to have cannabinoids. But coming back to your question, yeah, I think that for the most part, like, patients are, you know, very, very open to this. In terms of, you know, the medical community, it's a little bit odd. Like, I find that when I talk to anyone in person, they're like, yes, like, this is definitely the way to do it. But then when you go online, you'll see, you know, a lot of people kind of hating on alternative medicine. There's all these kind of crazy sort of like super left-winged people online that just label everything as misinformation. They think that everything that jacked healthy people do is completely wrong and incorrect, and that everything that they're doing is completely right, which makes absolutely no sense. So, you know, it's a little bit hit or miss. You know, some people, again, are very, very, you know, where they were upset for instance, when I opened an IV clinic, which unfortunately I had to shut down. So, you know, I was giving people NAD plus. That was basically what we were doing for like 90% of our patients or more. And then, you know, we did have some, you know, just regular vitamin drips in there too with B's and C's, but we'd put in, you know, other stuff there too. Like, we could do like some L-carnitine and some other things that can, you know, glutathione, like glutathione pushes and things like that, which, you know, a lot of people did seem to benefit from and appreciate. But unfortunately, like I said, you know, the CPS order kind of came down on me, so I had to cut ties with the clinic and shut it down, which is unfortunate. So, you know, there is still a lot of resistance. And I will say on this too, that, like, if you are on, you know, I hate using the terms, you know, left and right, but it's just, you know, they just kind of fit the, like, what I'm kind of describing.
Where we're at.
Yeah, it's unfortunately. But if you are one of these, you know, crazy left-wing COVIDians, you can say whatever you want online. You can say whatever you want online. You can be as wrong as you can. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter. The medical community will not come after you. It doesn't matter. You, as long as you're on the left side, you can say whatever you want. You can be as crazy as you want. But if you want to be centered or say something a little bit on the right side, or just put out, you know, some evidence-based information, you're going to get, like, hammered if it's not with the mainstream narrative. So, you know, that's kind of my thoughts on it overall. But like I said, in person, like, every single doctor I pretty much talk to is like, man, you're doing such a great job. This is, you know, something that we should all be doing. But most people are just, you know, they're afraid of losing their license and they're afraid of the CPSO.
Yeah, it's a real truth and real reality. It's absolutely disgusting to see what's happening to doctors that are pushing back against this narrative, that are truly looking after their patients rather than just going down what they're being told to do. Like, again, you're seeing that with yourself, you're seeing it with Jordan, you're seeing it with other individuals. My psychiatrist, who is the head of one of the first to ever do research on PTSD post Rwanda, you are seeing it with doctors who are willing to think outside of the box and look at the narrative and go, this isn't working for my patient, but this is, and this is a plant. And until they find a way to make money from it, they're not going to accept and allow this. And now we're seeing this. Let's step into the psychedelic component a little bit here, entheogens and pathogens. This is where I am a psychedelic integration coach, and I talk a lot about psychedelics and, you know, the classics and ones that we are seeing kind of being brought out into the public to fix a lot of issues. But I do see something happening with ketamine that I find, I don't want to say worrisome or concerning, but I do see it being blanket used for a lot of different things because ketamine is the only legally acceptable prescribable outside of cannabis, even though cannabis is considered, if I'm not mistaken, a master plant as well, and having the same components as a psychedelic, where if used in the right set and setting does have a similarity. But with things like ketamine, I'm seeing it used in a multitude of different ways. And some companies have reached out to me and said like, hey, will you push our product? And that makes me feel icky and gross and disgusting because they are looking at putting ketamine in the home without integration and without having a doctor present. And I'm not saying, in my opinion, I don't believe a psychiatrist needs to be present for this, but there does need to be a trained individual that is trained in psychedelic integration to be with that patient. But I am seeing clinics leave patients alone in rooms while they go through these experiences. And that to me is concerning, as well as the overarching blanket use of ketamine. So can we talk a little bit about ketamine, what you find the use for, how your patients have responded with it, and really what you see going down the road with this psychedelic?
Sure. So I've been prescribing ketamine now for about 5 years, which is, you know, a pretty long time compared to, you know, most other physicians. And technically, so it obviously does produce like psychedelic like effects, but technically, it's an anesthetic. Yes.
Correct.
And so the reason why, you know, I'm able to prescribe it is because it is used, you know, in ORs all over Canada. You know, we have to have ketamine. It's used in the emergency rooms as well. So with ketamine, so there's kind of two groups of patients that I have with ketamine. So now in terms of, you know, what they come in for, you know, certainly there's more, you know, than two groups, but it's mostly, you know, mental health and chronic pain. But right. The patients that come in, so I have patients who, you know, want to use ketamine on their own. And then I have patients who want to use ketamine with a psychotherapist. And so the issue is that if I issue ketamine to be taken with a psychotherapist, that person then has to pay that psychotherapist, you know, several hundred dollars, right?
Per session too.
Per session. And unfortunately, you know, most people that I see, you know, 80% or more just cannot do that.
No.
So unfortunately, the only way I can have my patients take ketamine where they can afford it is if they do take it at home. So, you know, go ahead.
I just have a question about that. Yeah. It's not that there's an issue with, having it at home, it's the dosage and the dissociative level that people can get to. So like when you're saying you're having it at home, are you talking about from a micro dosing perspective?
I'll tell you exactly how much I use. So we usually use capsules or lozenges.
Okay. Yeah.
And then what the dose that I generally use for people starting out is 50 milligrams. Sometimes I use 75 milligrams, but usually it's 50. So, you know, if you go to places like Field Trip or some other places, they usually use, seems to me like 300 is sort of like the classic starting dose for most people who use ketamine with a psychotherapist or with someone there. Like I said, you know, that would be ideal for my patients, but they can't, you know, afford it. So we're just trying to do some kind of bridge in between to give them some kind of relief. So, you know, what I do is I just prescribe them very, very small amounts, like 50 to 75 milligrams, where, you know, for the many times, you know, and this is where starting low and going slow is good. Like I do say to patients, like, listen, like you may not feel anything, like particularly with, you know, 50 milligrams and you're a big person. And then the other part of that too, is that it's very, very poorly absorbed orally. So unless you have an empty stomach and you take ketamine, it's pretty much not going to do anything. Like if you are, you know, even if you're naive to ketamine and you just ate a full stomach and you take some orally, you're probably not going to get much of a response. So, you know, one thing that sort of like factors into the safety of it is the fact that it can't be like, you can't just have a panic attack and say, oh, I'm just going to swallow a bunch of ketamine and it's going to go away because it's, unless your stomach is empty, it's not going to happen.
Right.
And then the other thing too, like I said, is the dose. But I don't disagree with anything that you said, like at first. Like I do think that, you know, patients ideally should do it with a psychotherapist, but it's just that unfortunately, you know, most people can't afford it. And it's the same thing with cannabis too. I mean, probably 80 to 90% of my patients, you know, don't take as much cannabis as they need to because they simply can't afford it. So they're just trying to, like, you know, really spare a whole CBD bottle throughout a month or 2 months just because they can't afford more of it.
And we're seeing that right now as Canada's legislation is looking to change. We did the Senate subcommittee, all different languages today. The Senate subcommittee, we had that meeting with them last May and they had their report findings come out. I think it was September, October of 23, where they stated, you know, the emerging treatments, council was able to say, look, we need to be putting funding into this. We absolutely need to be putting funding into research around psychedelics and emerging treatments, especially for veterans and first responders, because what they're starting to witness is, and I'm sure you're seeing this or hearing this with your patients as well, veterans are no longer going to wait for the government to find a solution. We will leave the country and we will go pay for ourselves and go to other countries, third world countries, which is astonishing that we have to leave what is considered supposed to be one of the freest, best healthcare systems in our world to go to third world countries like Peru and Mexico to access plant medicine, to heal our issues that Veterans Affairs is either saying are non-existent and do not exist, are not service related, or they're just strictly saying that they're never going to put funding into. So seeing the door open with things like ketamine, seeing that it is an option, the concern that I do have coming down with what legislation looks like is saying that there has to be a psychiatrist or a psychologist in the room. That to me just opens up another bottleneck situation like we already currently have with the mental health epidemic, that you cannot see a psychiatrist or psychologist in a timely manner. You don't even have them in the ERs anymore because they just cannot handle the rotations. There's too many people. It's too much of a problem. So in doing it the way that the government is looking to expand this program, the concern lies for me with, we are already in a bottleneck situation. This is only going to make it significantly worse. And if we were able to train others who do not have PhDs in these different healing modalities, which there are plenty, and we see a lot of, we call in America 501(c)s or nonprofits, things like Heroic Hearts Project and Vet Solutions. We're seeing incredible results in long-term healing, as well as coupled with research with Imperial School of London and other major universities doing these research projects around psilocybin and ayahuasca and MDMA in Australia. So how does Canada move forward with this so that we are not bottlenecking and we're not going to continually run into these problems as we roll these new healing modalities out?
Yeah, I think that's a huge issue. And again, like you're just talking about, like, you know, restricting access. And like, right, again, that's just going to add another barrier. And so, you know, someone wants to get psychedelic psychotherapy, you know, they have to be seen by, you know, only so many trained therapists who have this particular designation. Like, that's absolutely ridiculous. Now, what would be ideal is if, you know, people had the opportunity to do, you know, essentially, or have a choice. So yes, they could go see and pay the, you know, $2,000 or $5,000 for the, you know, 5 ketamine sessions with a, you know, trained double board certified, you know, psychologist, neurologist, or whoever it is that's going to be doing that. But also too, like, hey, I'm okay to pay, you know, Kelsey, who's trained someone for in a month in her program, you know, whatever it is. I'm just kind of making stuff up.
A lot,
like,
more than, like, a month, but we're gonna go with that.
Yeah, okay. But like, you know, I'm willing to pay, you know, Kelsey's, you know, $100 an hour or $150 an hour, whatever it is, something more like reasonable to, you know, get access to the medicine and also have, you know, some kind of, you know, psychotherapy. So I think that what they need to do is they need to expand it, right? And then, but within the expansion, you can still have different designations, meaning like right. people can still make that choice. Like someone may just feel more comfortable with some kind of, you know, double board certified, you know, physician versus someone may have the personality where, you know, I don't really want to see someone in a white coat. You know, I'd rather see someone who, you know, kind of went through it themselves. And, you know, I want to see someone different. So I think that we need to be able to expand that and make sure that people do have access and not restrict access. And, you know, that's what I'm trying to kind of do with like the ketamine right now, like with my patients. Like I said, like, if you have a psychotherapist, by all means, you know, do your ketamine with a psychotherapist. You probably will get more out of it. But if you're like actively suicidal, I can't just say to someone, oh, I'm not going to give you ketamine because you can't do ketamine with a psychotherapist, when I know that if they took a little bit of ketamine at home, at least their suicidal thoughts would be gone. You know, maybe they wouldn't be able to get, you know, as much work done. They wouldn't be able to do as much deep work, but they would, and like relieve as much emotional trauma, that kind of stuff. But at least they would get some kind of benefit. And so, you know, and I'm not saying that you or anyone else, you know, who is a trained psychedelic therapist would do worse or would do a poorer job than someone who is, you know, a physician who's double board certified or whatever. But, you know, we do need to be able to give those people different options, because the price point, like that's what it's taught, like that's what we're talking about here, right?
Yeah.
Like we're talking about the price point, and like, you know, it shouldn't be, but it is becoming that, like, it's going to come to a point where only like 1 or 2% of the population are going to have access to the best medical yeah. care. And that's what we're trying to prevent. And, but that is the way that things are going. Like even with all these like genetic testing and things like that, that people are doing, like, you know, the people that I see in my office who are on ODSP, who live on a couple thousand dollars a month or less, like, you know, they may never, ever get that opportunity. So we have to offer something, some kind of bridge in the meantime.
Absolutely. And that's something we're seeing a lot in Canada happen. We are seeing an overabundance of flooding in, like America, of individuals that don't pay taxes, but are utilizing our systems, which are bogging down our systems, which the people who are paying into are not getting timely access. And we are seeing it. Oh, I see something once.
Yeah, I do want to mention something there. So, you know, this is a little bit of a difficult thing to say in some ways, but just regards to, you know, immigration and things like that coming over. Okay. Anyone should be able to answer this question, honestly. If someone's speaking to you in a different language, obviously that appointment is going to be much more difficult and it's going to take much, much longer.
You think?
Okay. Like that's obvious. Okay. If I have to see 10 people who can't yeah. speak English versus 10 people who can speak English, I'm going to see those people who can't speak English much, much more slowly. So that means that less and less people are going to be seen. So if the government is going to, you know, accept all these immigrants and send them to the doctor's office, they should be sending an interpreter with them or something right. so that people can actually be seen quickly. Because if someone, again, you know, doesn't speak the language, it's going to take much, much longer. And so I just wanted to interject that there, because you're talking about, you know, bottlenecks in the healthcare system. That is a major bottleneck that people will not discuss because they think that they're going to sound racist or something like that. But if someone doesn't speak the language, it's going to take longer, period.
Well, it's not racist. It's a stark reality we're running into in this country. And a lot of people, again, don't want to have this conversation. I'm really glad that you're willing to, because it comes from I think intent matters, and intent with your words is, in my opinion, all that matters. So the intent here is not to bash immigrants. The intent is to go, look, this is what the Canadian healthcare system looks like currently. This is what it looks like with an influx of individuals from wherever they've come from, who are not paying taxes, who are not bringing doctors, and who are bogging down the system because they're either just so fresh that they don't speak English. They are unwilling to learn the language, which we do see. I do see regularly where I live. There's a reason it's called Vancouver. That is not me saying it. That's every other Vancouverite saying it. There is bottlenecks that happen, and they happen for several different reasons, but they do also happen because individuals are unwilling to learn the language of the country that they're living in. And that's not racist. That's my neighbors don't speak English who have been here 9 years. So when the bee's nest comes every fucking summer in the same spot, and I have to have the same conversation to protect my son who doesn't do well when he's stung, we found out, we have to do this again. And I have to learn Mandarin to have this ni hama, ni hama, And then we start from there, and then we go from there, and then we do a lot of hand gestures, and we go, huh, like, what are we doing here? My point
is... So you understand what I'm talking about, then,
dude,
obviously.
This is why people have a hard time. Well, how dare you say that? Okay, here's a beautiful example. When I go to China, when I go to Taiwan, when I travel across the globe or I go to other countries, I do not expect them to speak English to me. When I go to France and I speak French from Quebec, they don't even speak to me in French. They will translate into English because, like, you're embarrassing. My point is...
Je parle français, just so you know.
I know, but nobody should need to hear that on this show. So... I'm serious. I did French in my book, in the audiobook, and I did French accents for people to understand what I had to live with because it was ridiculous. My point is if we go to another country and we are accessing a healthcare system, say I walk into Italy and I need to go to the hospital there, do you think they're going to speak English to me? No.
No.
Is that racist or prejudice? No. No. Is that the country they live in and you're a visitor in it? Yes. So it's no different than being in Canada. If you speak English or French, these are the languages that we are taught here. Now, if I go to Richmond, tell me if there's an English sign present. No. What is present? Chinese only. Cool. So we have this happening in this country. I would never go to one of their doctors because they don't speak English very well. I'm not going to try, but I'm also not going to sit here and blindly say that this isn't part of the problem, because it is. When you have an overabundance like America does right now with no borders, flooding in of individuals who do not speak the language, and then you're putting them into the system and trying to provide them with care that every human being should have access to, regardless of where you're from or language you speak, the problem doesn't become whether you should have access. The problem becomes the language that is spoken is not one that the doctors who are trying to treat you are speaking. Meaning, if you want adequate care, you need to come with a translator or at least learn English. And if you're not going to, then there needs to be a separate line for somebody that speaks your language, because the rest of us who pay exorbitant, unbelievable, backbreaking amounts of taxes to have access to a healthcare system that would rather kill you than heal you, we should have the right to see doctors, not for 5 minutes as I'm saying a sentence and you're pushing me out the door. We should have a right to see doctors in a timely manner if you pay taxes here. If you don't, I don't know what to tell you, but stop it, because I'm tired of my family not being able to go see a fucking doctor in a timely manner.
Yeah, it's wild. It's straight up the best point you made there is it is dangerous. You know, like, it's dangerous for me and it's dangerous for the patients. It's like, I, you know, sometimes like have a very, very difficult time. Like, they have no English. It's very difficult for me to even understand they're trying to like request. And so I don't want to do the wrong thing and, you know, make the patient even worse off than they are. Like, it's straight up dangerous. Like, you should only, like, you should really try to only communicate with doctors who speak your language or speak a language that you both know. Like, that's safe medicine.
The nuances of like your past medical history and the medications you're on and the contraindications that can happen if something's prescribed incorrectly are dangerous. And then that will fall on your hands as being the individual who tried to help that patient. I know we don't have a lot of time, so I'm going to shift.
No, I got a little bit of time.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Perfect.
You got like 20 minutes or so.
Okay. Perfect. Cause I got a lot of things right here.
It's all good. So. It's all good. I'm ready. I'm ready.
It's all right. You're coming back on, cause we got to have some deep 100%. Conversations. Perfect. So 100%. let's go into, I've seen your little comments about cold. I love this because everybody, the newest reels coming out around cold are like, hey, so these cold plunge people, they're like coming for the world. It's like, cause we are. So let's talk about cold in a very realistic, healthy way. You don't need to be in 32 degree temperature water. You don't need hypothermia. It needs to suck, but it doesn't need to suck that bad. And everybody can do it. And everybody should have access if you just use a rubber made from Canadian Tire like I do. So talk to me about cold, Mike.
Sure. So, you know, I do think cold plunges are awesome. You know, do I think that they're overrated? I mean, it's it's your expectation. Like, if you do a cold plunge, it will make you feel better for at least 2.5 to 6 hours.
Yes. Right?
There is a dopamine response to it. So like, you know, when people say like, you know, it's magic or it's amazing. Like, I mean, doing like exposing yourself for like 5 minutes and then feeling better for like 2 to 6 hours, that's pretty awesome. Like, that's a pretty wicked return on investment for your time. So, like, I think cold plunges are awesome. You know, what I was talking about the other day, though, I think what you're referring to is, yeah, there was a study done. You know, I saw Andrew Huberman actually posted it a couple of years ago. So I want to give credit to him. That's where I learned it from. But, you know, he said there's some people who, you know, they may not have access to a cold plunge, maybe just have a cold shower. You know, this particular study was cold water submersion, but I do think it mostly applies to cold showers as well. But, you know, what they did is that they took some women, I think there was 20 or 30 women in the study, something like that. I think it was over 35. And they put them in 5 minutes of water that was at 68 degrees Fahrenheit or 20 degrees Celsius, which again is not that cold. And they still got tremendous benefits. So, you know, are you going to get the same dopamine response as someone who's in like a 34 degree pool? Probably not, but you're still going to feel like pretty fucking awesome after. So I think that it's a wicked return on investment. Like, all you have to do is like be cold for a few minutes and then you get to feel awesome for a few hours. So I think that, you know, it's something that, you know, people should utilize if they're not, you know, utilizing it. I'm not saying that like you have to do it, but it, you know, it definitely works and it definitely revs up your dopamine system. And I'm a big believer in it.
Well, I think it's fantastic twofold. You've got the dopamine response, which is amazing because people we know now are either dopamine deficient because they're constantly on their phone scrolling and they just, their brains blow out. And it is a healthy alternative in getting people outside to expose themselves to difficult things. I'm a big believer in mindset shifting. Yeah. So when you're building resiliency within a human being, I think it's incredibly important to put them through micro doses of adversity that are not going to push them away from the modality in a way that's like shocking to the system. I think cold is great for that alone because you do see not only the dopamine response, but you do see an aversion to people's reactions through difficult, stressful events throughout the day post cold exposure. And as you do that on a continual basis, you see these people develop a very different mindset. And as their mindset shifts and the perception shifts, the reality gets easier to handle. And so I love it from that component. I found it fascinating the temperature wise, because some of my friends still feel like they need to torture me when I'm visiting, which is fine. But I'm just saying, I think it's something that people should have access to. And I've said this time and time again, you do not need to go to any of the big companies and spend tens of thousands of dollars. You can go to Canadian Tire or go to Lowe's or go anywhere else and grab yourself a huge Rubbermaid or go get a horse trough and expose yourself to water. It doesn't need to be expensive. And the excuses you're making are bullshit. Just saying.
I agree 100%. You can, everyone has access to a cold shower and, you know, most people have access to a bathtub. So, you know, you can easily make a cold shower if you want to, or a cold tub if you want. You can go to the gas station if you really want to and get, you know, tons of ice bags and throw it in. So
do it all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not that difficult. It is an excuse. So I appreciate you calling people out on that.
Oh, I have no issue with that at all. It seems to be where I'm at in this world.
It's great.
For your social media, maybe not mine. Let's get let's get a little further into something else controversial that I've always been against, and I'm starting to really get angry about, is this over-prescribing of birth control. Why do we feel it's necessary the second a 14-year-old gets her period for the first time to go, that's not normal, let's fuck your hormones up instead?
So, I mean, birth control is something that came around, I guess it was in the 50s or 60s or something like that. And it was really supposed to like empower women in a lot of ways, right? I mean, I think the main reason though why most people get on birth control is to not get pregnant, right? And obviously not getting pregnant when you're a teenager, you know, sometimes can work out for people, right? You know, lots of teen pregnancies do work out. Lots of people have, you know, early kids and it works out. I have friends that have had teen pregnancies and, you know, their kids are great and they're great and it works out. But, you know, people do want to avoid pregnancy. You know, are there other ways that are as effective as, you know, birth control? You know, maybe not as effective, but you can use condoms. Obviously you can make sure that you're, you know, not having sex when someone's ovulating. Like there are other methods that you can use to decrease your chances, but you know, people obviously are just really, really concerned about, you know, pregnancy kind of ruining their life. So, you know, they opt for birth control. Now, what are like the downsides of it? I think you had something to say there.
Yeah. I mean, it could be like the IUDs perforating uteruses that leave you never able to have children, or just the hormone imbalances and gut health and long-term damage on your sex drive all through your 20s. Or, you know, just the fact that women have to bury the brunt of like what that means hormonally. I'm not saying it's not a good solution, but what I am saying is that when a 14-year-old who's not even sexually active, who doesn't plan on it and isn't, who are then prescribed because it's just like the easy thing to do while causing blood clots, which most doctors know if you have a blood issue in your family, and then still prescribing it, it just feels like an easy out. And it doesn't, I've never heard one doctor, not one, ever look at me and have this conversation and talk about the repercussions of long-term use of birth controls hormonally.
So the birth control hormonally, so one of the ones that, you know, people prescribe in Canada is called Yaz. It's very, very popular. And I was talking with my friend on a podcast recently about it. And, you know, we were saying that if you use Yaz, it can drop your free testosterone, right? So a lot of women, I know, you know, you're aware of it, Kelsey, but a lot of women are not aware that, you know, women have more testosterone than estrogen in their body. So, you know, testosterone is critically important for women. So again, I'm not saying that women have more testosterone than men. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying that within the female body, milligram per milligram, there is more testosterone than estrogen. So it's, you know, critically important. And just like, you know, testosterone is important for men, for well-being, for mood, for sex drive, you know, for cognition, for energy, women need that for the exact same reasons too. And so, you know, when you put someone on birth control and their free testosterone drops and their sex drive goes, and maybe they're not performing as well in the gym and their energy goes and their mood's not good, then, you know, you can potentially attribute that to the hormone pill or to the birth control pill, because it can decrease free testosterone. So, you know, that's probably the one of the main mechanisms by which, you know, females do, you know, suffer, you know, short-term and long-term consequences is from its hormonal effects. And again, you know, contrary to what many people believe, it's more of a testosterone issue than say like an estrogen or a progesterone issue, which, you know, surprises a lot of people.
Well, birth control is just a fascinating one, and I'm seeing it, just, you know, 12 and 13 year olds and 11 year olds prescribed it for men.
Yeah. And I was going to say, so, you know, people use it, what other indications do they use it for besides, preventing pregnancy? So some people will use it, particularly as one Diane 35 people use for acne. But you know, there's lots of other topical treatments that can be used for acne. You know, clindamycin can be effective, and there's other ones as well, like just like some isotretinoin, you know, can be effective as well, just like basically topical Accutane. So, you know, there are other treatments that people can use, you know, to treat acne. And obviously there's like gut and diet, and there's a lot of things to treat acne. So I'm not going to get into all of it, but you know, there are other pharmaceuticals that can treat acne as well. And like I said, you know, we can get into it maybe another time in terms of other things like gut health and that, but you know, there are other things that we can use to treat acne, and I don't think that should be one of the main reasons why people go on. And they certainly shouldn't be on it if they're like, if you're trying to not get pregnant, okay, fine, I can kind of understand that. But if it's for any other reason, I would really, you know, wouldn't put myself on it.
Yeah, I had a lovely individual named Danielle Kepix that came on the show that specializes in women's health. And I got to tell you, that was a spicy episode, because my God, did I ever learn a lot. So let's get into some other things we're seeing that you can speak to that not a lot of people can speak to, that I know our listeners want to talk about, which is what is going on with healthcare in Canada right now, and how, as an individual who's in the ERs, who's with the patients, how are you seeing healthcare? And this is me putting words in your mouth. How are you seeing healthcare fail right now?
Yeah. So, I mean, we are seeing it fail. And I will say that, you know, I can speak mostly for Ontario, but I can speak for all of Canada as well. But the one of the biggest issues right now is that there's no family doctors. And the other part is that there's no family doctors that want to work, you know?
Why?
So, Well, in Ontario, and again, this is a little bit of controversial opinion, but they introduced these faux and fin capitation models where, you know, and it was in good intention, I think, where patients or where doctors would get paid based upon how many patients they had in their roster and not necessarily based upon like how many patients they could see in an hour. So not like fee for service like I am. So I get paid basically based upon how many patients I see. But then what they, you know, didn't really, I think, factor into this is human nature. And so, you know, I think that what's happened is, yes, we do have an aging population. Yes, we have more people. Yes, we have more immigrants. There's, I mean, this is obviously multifactorial here. But at the same time, if someone's not really motivated to work, they tend to just end up working less. And so, you know, that's why I think one of the main reasons in Ontario anyway, where people are, you know, not able to see a family doctor is because they're under these, you know, fin and faux capitation models where they can get paid the same as to see, you know, a dozen patients a day as someone who maybe sees, you know, 40 patients a day or something like that. So that's a real big issue. But yeah, I mean, coming back to, you know, I'll get into the system itself, but for sure the other things are the aging population that we have, the increasing population that we have, and the, you know, the immigrants that are coming in as well. And then maybe I should have said this actually first, people aren't taking care of themselves.
No,
right. So,
not.
So 40 to 50 years ago, there was a lot less patients that had diabetes. There's a lot less patients that had high blood pressure and, you know, everything. And then I look at, you know, kids, you know, I posted this on my Twitter like the other day, I think it was yesterday. I mean, I see kids that are like 16 years old and they have full blown diabetes. Jeez. I do an ultrasound on them and they have fatty liver. Like it's crazy. And like, you know, someone's got to be held responsible for that. Like sure, at 16, you know, kids should learn, you know, a little bit more about nutrition and, you know, and take some kind of ownership. But at the same time, like that does take time. And like, you know, a lot of this, I think, falls upon the teachers and the parents who are mostly the parents who are for like feeding these children, you know? And so I think that has a huge impact on the healthcare system is, you know, just the sickness of the overall patients. But getting back to the healthcare system itself, like a lot of it, I think, does come down to the family doctors, because if you can't get a family doctor, you can't get a referral. If you can't get in to see a family doctor, you're going to end up going to Emerge, you know, and then if you're a family doctor, if you do have a family doctor, and this happens a lot in Ontario, it's a lot of times they won't see you for 2 weeks.
That's right.
Like if you're sick and you have like an earache happens like overnight and like the next day, like, so, you know, there's a lot of things going on within the healthcare system, but I think one thing that we, like, we can't fix an aging population. People are going to get older, you know, but one thing that we can do within the healthcare system is we can potentially get more family doctors. And I think that would at least make a little bit of a difference and take a little bit of a load off of the ERs. But I mean, it's absolutely crazy. I mean, to try to get in to see someone, like even myself, I had a back injury. I'd seen a nurse practitioner, I'd seen a sports medicine physician, you know, and I tried to get in for like an injection and I just couldn't get in. Like they rejected my referral. It's like, I'm in excruciating pain. I've had seen two different like physicians, you know, like what do I have to do to become a legitimate, you know, client? Eventually I got someone in Toronto to do it and it worked out amazing. I know not everyone's for a cortisone shots, but for me, it was fucking unreal, like single best intervention I've ever had in my life. So, you know, there's a lot of different issues going on there. Hopefully I answered your question a little bit.
No, it helps give people perspective that are listening, because they only ever hear me complain about our healthcare system while out of the same breath saying, well, but don't you have free healthcare? You know, we pay monthly. OHIP, it comes out of your, you know, it comes out of your stuff. But BC, we pay monthly. It goes in. If you don't pay, you don't get it. And if you do, well, you still barely get it. So, you know, we see things with, you know, people not getting access to surgeons in a timely manner. TBI treatments, I had to go to America for treatment. This week, they sent my son home with a free-floating fluid around his appendix while having elevated white blood cells and said, we'll see what happens. So, you know, and these are supposed to be our specialists and the people that are supposed to be maintaining our healthcare system. And it's not that every doctor is having a negative mindset, but we are seeing quick fixes. We're not seeing hard conversations with patients around what they're putting in their bodies and how they're looking after themselves and the ownership and responsibility that's on the individual. It's not on the healthcare systems to fix you. It's on you to fix you in a way before you go to a doctor and actually ask them to go internally. You have to do everything you can. You have to sleep properly. You have to eat properly. You have to surround yourself with the right people and you have to surround yourselves in the right environments. If you're always in a negative environment, nothing is going to grow properly. So
it's true.
In saying that, you know, with what you have going on in Ontario and all of these things that are happening with the system there, how do you stay positive? What are the things that you do? What are some pieces of advice that you could give to the listeners that are like, okay, Canada's falling apart, but at least I can be doing these things to keep myself healthy. So hopefully I don't have to become another burden on the system.
Don't get sick.
Don't get sick.
Try not to get sick. Honestly, that's like what you want to do is you want to do as much preventative medicine and self-care yes. as possible. Like that's the thing that you want to do, because if you do become sick, you are probably going to have, you know, a difficult time getting access to proper care. Like, I'm sorry that I can't just, you know, give someone, you know, a real, you know, feel good statement here and say, oh, this is what you have to do if you want a good, you know, access right. to healthcare in Canada. Like that doesn't exist. Right. So what I think you should do is just try your best to take care of yourself. And then, yeah, I mean, try to find a doctor who is, you know, like-minded like you. I mean, they probably are few and far between, but, you know, try to find someone. Like, you know, Google is something that can be used, you know, for good. Sometimes obviously people use Google sometimes and they go down rabbit holes and waste a lot of time, but, you know, you can Google doctors and see if they're, you know, more into your life.
Functional medicine.
And like, just like, and this kind of sounds a little bit almost bro-ish, but like, try to find just like a jacked doctor, you know, try to
somebody
find
somebody healthy talking to you.
Yeah. Try to find like a healthy doctor, but if you can, try to find someone who's jacked, you know, and if they're female, you know, they can still be jacked or, you know, to a different extent. You're jacked for a female, but you still have, you know, a female petite physique.
I'm in
jacked.
A very large sweater right now. You cannot tell my jackness. I like
it. But, you know, so find someone who looks fit. I think if you find someone who looks fit, you'll probably, you know, end up being a better fit, pardon the pun. So I think that, you know, that would be my approach is, you know, do as much preventative medicine as possible, and then just try to make connections with the right people and try to find a doctor who's super fit.
I think that's a great, genuinely, I think that's a great, great way to end it, because people will take advice from 400-pound doctors about how to heal themselves. And it's just, it's irrational. And personally, I've seen enough doctors now in our ERs to go that it's irresponsible. And we don't have to be like North Korea and China and say that you can't graduate high school if you don't have a certain body fat, but we can hold our doctors and our teachers and those people who are influencing our growing population, and we should hold them to a higher standard because they are the ones that are interfacing. I will say naturopaths have been very helpful. Our naturopath is ripped. He clearly does marathons. It's obnoxious, but he is willing to go to the ends of the earth to find the thing that we need. And if so, we go out of the country, because sometimes you got to pay to play. And if you can't pay to play, I'm really sorry, but do everything you can preventatively. Preventative medicine is going to be the best thing for you. Vitamin D, I know, is such a huge one. Most people are deficient, especially in Canada.
Yeah.
Massive.
Yeah. And get sunlight in your eyes. I think I said at the beginning of the podcast, but that's so important to regulate your bedtime. Like it's so important. It'll do so much for you. And even just like, you know, with regards to stress management, and I know you got to go here in a sec, but like with regards to stress management, and people say that they're stressed, it's because you have poor systems set up. Like when I wake up in the morning, I know exactly what I'm going to do that day. Like I knew exactly what time I was going to wake up today. I knew exactly what I was going to eat. I knew exactly what time I was going to come to the clinic. I knew exactly when I was going to come here. Like everything is planned and scheduled, and that's why I'm able to do it. And if something is failing, I don't think like, oh, I'm stressed, I'm overwhelmed, I need to get rid of this. I think I need a better system. I need a better routine here. I need a better protocol. There's something that I'm doing that can be improved, because there's other people out there who are more productive than me. And I think they just have a better system set up, better protocols, better routines. So if you're feeling stressed, don't just dump everything. Try to find a better routine, a better protocol, and figure it out.
And if you can't find one and you're struggling to, then you call me and we help do that together.
Hell yeah, they do.
That's it. It's not that hard, man. It's not. When you look at perspective and when you push it away and go, how do we manage? It's doable. It is completely doable. You can heal yourself. You can heal using community. You can heal using plant medicine. You can heal using traditional medicine. But ultimately, first and foremost, what goes into your body matters. How you sleep matters. Those you surround yourself matter. Whether you drink water matters. Start, just turn off the fucking news. I think that's a real good
Drink
start.
water.
Drink
Hell
water.
yeah. Turn off the news is a great start.
That's like one of
Don't
my favorites.
watch CBC ever. If you want to be
Ever.
depressed, watch CBC and
Watch
listen to
it.
Justin Trudeau.
Oh God. I've gotten to the point now where I physically have a reaction when I see his smirk or Christina Freeland. I see them and I go,
Oh,
oh.
Chrissy Freeland's the worst. But I was
Wait.
at UFC 297 in TO.
Yeah, so you went, right?
Oh yeah, I was certainly part of the chance. It was
Of
great.
course you were. Of course you were
Of
part of
course.
those chants. I would expect nothing else from you. Why would I even have you on the fucking show if I didn't know you were one of our people? And I'm not talking left or right. I'm talking about a person who believes in preventative healthcare, looking after themselves, not being told that they have to take a bunch of blank to feel good, and then also just showing up for their own mental health and their community. And Mike, you are one of those people. So I'm really stoked to have had you on. You're going to come back on. I think this should be a pretty frequent thing because I think for
Let's
Canadians,
do
most
it.
people don't have access to people like you. And I think you're a breath of fresh air in the medical field. So thanks for being with us today. Can you tell everyone where they can follow you, find you, and get support through you?
Sure. If you want to follow me, I'm Dr. Mike Hart on everything. So it's DrMikeHart. I'm on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, not on LinkedIn because they booted me off there permanently for sharing peer-reviewed data. My website is MikeHartMD, and my clinic is ReadyToGoClinic.com. But thank you so much for having me on. This was a wicked conversation. I'm super looking forward to coming back on. And yeah, I'd love to do this regularly.
Awesome, man. Okay, well, you stick with me. Everyone else, we'll see you all next week.